Conversations with Consequences. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association, where we aim to change the culture one conversation at a time. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern, or catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on Sirius XM Channel 130. Of course, our radio show is always a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org/podcasts or directly to wherever you listen to your podcasts. Joining us next are two special guests. We have Mary Fiorito, who is an old friend of the show. She's an attorney and also a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and a friend of hers. We're very proud and happy to have on because her life story, I think you will find very inspiring and illuminating. Her name is Kiara Burke. I've asked Mary and Kiara to come on because of a case that's going on in Texas right now of a woman who is pregnant with her third child, and the child has trisomy 18. Trisomy is a genetic abnormality in which one of the chromosomes is tripled instead of doubled, as is normal. So everyone's heard of Down syndrome. That's a trisomy. Another trisomy is trisomy 18. It's a much more severe, has a much more severe constellation of disability that comes with it, like Down's, but more severe. Most children with trisomy 18 die soon after birth. Now, with more care and more aggressive interventions, they can live longer, and some children have lived into early adulthood with trisomy 18. But in general, it's considered considered in most cases a disability not compatible with life after the child is born. The case in Texas is of a woman who wants an abortion, so she wants the baby not delivered early, but aborted. She's over 20 weeks pregnant already. And she went to the Texas Supreme Court to ask that the law, an exception be made in the law, because the law in Texas right now is that a woman can only have an abortion at those late stages if her life is in imminent danger. And that is simply not the case medically, because a woman who is pregnant with a baby who has trisomy 18 is not in any particular danger from her pregnancy. She's just, from her end, she's having a normal pregnancy. It's the baby that has a disability. So I think the latest thing is that the woman is going to actually leave Texas for her abortion. She's going to go somewhere else. So talking about this case, I filmed a little video and put it on Twitter because I happen to know of many families who have been faced with diagnoses in their children like this. And instead of having an abortion, even though their doctors press them, their OBGYNs generally press them to have an abortion, they have decided to receive the child with dignity and love, and then love that child to the end in something called a hospice, like perinatal hospice, which could be a place you go to or someone visits you. Kiara Burke, as I'm getting through this long introduction, Kiara Burke is someone who has experienced exactly this with a child who was born to her with trisomy 18. So welcome to the show, Kiara. Let me hand it over to you for you to tell us, give us a little snapshot of your experience that I think turned out to be very beautiful.
Sure. Thanks for having me on the show this morning. My husband, Rory, and I had four children, four girls at the time. This was about 4.5 years ago. And we were expecting our fifth baby, a boy. I went into a standard, typical 20-week ultrasound, and there were three markers on the ultrasound that raised concern that the baby might have some sort of chromosomal abnormality. So after they brought me back into the hospital the following day for further testing, and I had the cell-free DNA non-invasive blood test, which kind of, you know, tells you what your baby might or might not have. And, you know, we waited about a week for the results, and they came back that the baby who we had named Rory, our son definitely had trisomy 18. You know, after letting the medical professionals know we weren't going to go ahead, they did offer us a termination, and that was the only kind of option that they offered us at the time. And then when we kind of discussed it with the genetic counselors and the doctors, we said that we are not, you know, we're going to carry the baby to term. We are not going to terminate the baby. Then they kind of introduced the idea of a perinatal hospice program. After they knew for a fact that we weren't going to go ahead and terminate the baby. This kind of, from the diagnosis on throughout the whole pregnancy, we worked with the palliative care team and doctors and nurses and neonatologists and social workers. And they really just took our family in and encompassed us and walked us through everything from, you know, from the diagnosis through the birth and even during the short lifespan of 5 days that we had with our son. It was very beautiful. It was very supportive. And they just removed the stress and they just kind of took it day by day, week by week. You know, I went for further high level ultrasounds and the technician would say, you know, here's your baby. He's just doing his thing. He's doing his thing. You're doing your thing. He doesn't even know he's sick. Just keep plugging along. And that's what we did. And, you know, the doctors, they didn't want me to have a C-section because it's high risk. But I went into labor with Rory at 37 weeks. And I did have to end up having an emergency C-section due to hemorrhaging. But they just handled it as a normal birth. Like, we're going to deliver the baby. We don't know how long he will live. We're going to help you and the baby. So I, June 12th, baby Rory was born, and we had him at the hospital. The palliative care team took him right from the C-section, took care of him, resuscitated him, gave him all the means that he deserved as a baby and care. And they took him to us, to me and my husband and all of our children. And we had 3 days with him in the hospital, and then brought the baby home. And we had 2 days here with a hospice nurse team that would come and help us with the baby and myself and to watch, take care of him, watch his vital signs, help with the siblings, did art projects with him, you know, took little feet prints, pictures, you know, all these wonderful memories that we had with that very small window of time that we did have with him while he was with us. After that, June 16th, after spending 2 days with us at home, the palliative care team kind of prepared us for the baby's last hours. It's kind of, he just, you know, his body's shutting down and he very peacefully passed away in our living room. It was very beautiful. We had all of our family around, friends in and out, spending time with him and meeting him. And it was a very positive experience for my husband, for me, for our four other daughters, for everyone that got to witness a brief, you know, synopsis of it, and especially for Rory. You know, so he only knew love with us for the 5 days he was here. And it was very beautiful. It was a very, even though it was tragic and devastating, you're losing your child. That's going to happen anyway. But how you handle it moving forward, I think, can have a profound effect, obviously, on the baby, but also on your partner, your spouse, and your other children, should you have any children at the time. It just is how you kind of direct that decision moving forward.
Kara, you're telling me this story and it's making me cry. Oh. Because I've had five children and mm-hmm. and to think of saying goodbye to them soon after yes. you meet them and hold them in your arms, it's absolutely a terrible thought, a tragic thought. And yet you're telling us that there's beauty in it. Please just explain to me where the beauty is. Explain to all of us how you found the beauty.
Well, of course, you know, you're going to lose your baby. You're losing your baby regardless, right? The baby. But we, you know, there is, no matter the length of the life, whether it's, you know, from conception until, we're all terminal, right? So from the moment of conception, every one of us is terminal. So we decided to let the baby make his own decisions, align ourselves with nature, align baby Rory with nature, and let him guide the way. And we're back up. We're just following his lead. And that's what we did.
So it's something like deep respect, right? Deep respect for your child.
Deep respect. We loved him so much and we wanted to show him that love and be as close to him as we possibly could for as long as we could. And it is devastating and it is very tragic and there is suffering, of course. But at the end of the day, you're still losing your baby regardless. And we decided to take that and really show him and our other children, you know, no matter what his sickness is or illness, we're going to love him and care for him as long as we're able. And that was very therapeutic for us because he gave us so much. He loved us and we loved him unconditionally. And then you show your other children that there is unconditional love there. And, you know, he showed us he was a gift. And our children still remember that as one of their favorite days of their whole life was holding their little brother in their arms and spending time with him.
There seems to be a huge void in our culture these days around mm-hmm. death, around death, yes. and wanting to not have it be any kind of part of our life. And you can tie yes. up a lot of things into this. You can tie up abortion and assisted suicide and euthanasia, sure. and the way mm-hmm. that people don't have funerals anymore and they have yeah. celebrations of life. So mm-hmm. there's this like whole huge cultural void where death used yeah. to be, where we're accepting death as a natural event that comes to all of us right. that we can extract a lot of comfort from if we do it right, if we do it with dignity.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, in the history of humanity, I mean, people have passed away and died at various ages of life, right? From in the womb to shortly after birth to up to 89 to 100 years old, right? Mm-hmm. So that was just part of it. Back in the early times, many families, most families lost children just because that was just part of life, right?
Right.
Part of human nature. We all die. There is a societal stigma attached to that. Nobody wants to experience it. Nobody wants to know it exists. Nobody wants to picture themselves going through that or their child going through that. But you're still going to go through it. Even if you decide to terminate, you're still going to go through it.
It's something like either refusing to accept the reality and running away from it and participating and making yourself the one who ends the child's life versus approaching it forthrightly and with courage and shouldering that same burden and walking mm-hmm. with it proudly, right? Like, yeah, like for you, like you called it therapeutic, but it's like much bigger than that, right? It's a courageous, yeah. noble, honorable way of saying goodbye instead of and yeah. something you can be proud of the rest of your life and have, you know, something to hold when your baby's gone.
And you know, oh, thank you, doctor. You know, it was a very beautiful, through that suffering and tragedy, there is so much beauty. You saw it throughout the whole 5 days. You saw it at the hospital with all the doctors and nurses interacting. You saw it with all family members and friends. And then you saw it with the hospice team here. And you saw it with the siblings interacting with the baby. You saw the baby too. I mean, he just knew love for 5 days. And then he passed away. Not many people can say that. You know, he didn't know any suffering. The baby never, there's this kind of story that they create as if the baby's going to come out and just be tragically suffering and in immense pain. And why would anyone want to do this to their baby? And why would any parent want to put themselves through this? I think that's kind of what it is. Sometimes when you don't want to kind of put yourself through that suffering, so you're going to stop that option and go with the other option of perhaps terminating the baby because you don't want to walk that walk because it's the suffering is too great. And I think that that's a lot of feedback that I got from people. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of it, but with the right support that can kind of lessen that suffering and pain and help, I think that bring comfort and compassion. I think that you can totally change the realm, you know, for generations of how you treat, a baby with a life-limiting condition that a family has.
Mary, tell us, In the bigger picture of the way that that Americans are living in this post Dobbs world, right, where every state is walking its way through all these different conceptions of human life, the value of human life. When does human life become valuable? When do we respect and when do we don't? When we don't, what this case in Texas? How is it pointing out these fault lines in our culture around life?
Well, I think, you know, this and then a similar case that happened in Ohio a few months ago, they point to the fact that abortion advocates will take tragic circumstances like this and they will create a narrative that isn't reflective of reality, right, in order to capitalize on you know, very well-placed empathy and sympathy that people have for a woman like Kira, who is diagnosed with a life-limiting condition. That's a shock for any parent, you know, to receive something like that. And they're taking advantage of, again, feelings, I think, that come out of a very good place in order to try to further more extreme abortion laws. So, for example, in Texas does have an exception to its abortion law for medical necessities and for life-threatening conditions to the mother. And the Attorney General Paxson, in his public comments about it and in his statement to the three hospitals in Texas who might have participated in this abortion, was very clear that in the case of Kate Cox, her doctor did not make the appropriate case that this was a medically necessary abortion, either to save her life or to prevent some catastrophic damage to her health. And when you sort of dig down into the facts, and I think this woman may have very well have been taken advantage of by abortion advocates who were looking, you know, they're always looking for a test case, right? And when they're looking for a big test case, they're looking for, you know, the most extreme conditions possible, you know, in order to push this particular narrative. But, you know, she's a married woman. She wants to have more children. If this had been a healthy pregnancy, she had said she would have been perfectly comfortable with having a C-section. But now that it's a disabled child, now all of a sudden the narrative is that, you know, a C-section could harm my future fertility and also be a potential danger to me. But neither the doctor nor she with a straight face was able to make the case that having a C-section is going to threaten my life and my health. And I think you as a physician have made some excellent comments on Twitter that there's no safer time to be pregnant in the United States than nowadays, because we have such, you know, marvelous medical care in this country that, you know, death from a C-section is extremely rare, whereas death from a later second trimester abortion is actually quite dangerous. I mean, without getting graphic as to what goes on.
That's a really good point that you make, Mary. We know, those of us who are in medicine or you that are very informed, we understand that a C-section is a very safe procedure. An induction is a very safe procedure. She could also have been induced. But those late trimester, second and third trimester abortions are they're very, very traumatic for the mother, much more traumatic than a C-section or, I'm sorry, more traumatic than an abortion, either second or third trimester. I'm sorry, I said that backwards. Thus, the abortion is much more traumatic than a C-section or an induction. And so there's no medical advantage to aborting a baby for the mother than to deliver a child.
No. In fact, you know, I live in the state of Illinois, as does Kira, Gracie. And so we have abortion. I mean, our abortion clinics here advertise on their websites for elective procedures right up through 28 weeks. And some we know are doing them later, but I have friends who work in emergency rooms in, you know, nearby Indiana, which is maybe 90 minutes from us. And they have told me about the increase in patients coming in to their emergency rooms with things like perforated uteruses, with things like retained fetal body parts that then become infected. I mean, you know, these are not, it's not just like, you know, you swallow a pill and then the baby dissolves. And, you know, these are fully formed babies, either at the cusp of viability or already at viability, which we know is about 22 weeks now, 21 weeks in some rarer cases, but about 22 weeks. And we know that they're pain capable. So a D&E abortion, if they are, there's a couple of different ways they can do it. Sometimes they do an injection into the fetal heart, which goes right through the pleural cavity. And, you know, this is interesting.
Imagine doing that to a little infant in the neonatal ICU. Could you ever approach that delicate little chest with a 10-inch needle to
put it through the baby's lungs into the heart?
I mean, you wouldn't do that to a puppy, let alone a baby.
Well, no. That's a very good point. And I was on a radio program, a Catholic radio program in New York, with the host of the show was a retired Catholic deacon who is also a veterinarian. And he told me, we were talking about this because third trimester abortions are legal in New York as well. And he said, do you know, I cannot put an animal down that way unless I have sedated it or it's comatose. Mm-hmm. He said, I would mm-hmm. lose my veterinary license if
Absolutely.
I did that. You cannot do that to an animal in this country, but we're doing it to children mm-hmm. and who are pain capable and alive. And I had never heard, in all the years I've done pro-life, I'd never heard that explained to me. He said, no, you're going right through the lungs into the heart. That is with a big needle.
Kara, let me ask Kara about that. Kara, when you were when your doctors were pressuring you or offering you only abortion, did anyone talk about what the baby might be feeling who was already pain capable at that point?
No, that was never even discussed, brought up, addressed, not at all. But back into what the baby's feeling versus the mother's life, how the narrative, like Mary was saying, gets spun that it's for the health, the mother's health. This is the mother's life and her health. So when I was expecting Rory, they treated me and the baby together. The perinatal hospice team, they treated us both together. If there was, hypothetically speaking, something happening with my life at the time where my life was at risk, quote unquote, then go ahead and treat me, right? Treat the mother, fix her high risk. And if as an end result, something happens to the baby, then that happens, right? You're treating the issue, or you deliver the baby early. Aborting the baby is not going to solve anything, is it? Do you know what I'm saying? The mother's life at risk, they're using this as the story. No one's saying don't treat the mother. Go ahead and treat her. And if something happens to the baby, that may happen in some situations, or deliver the baby early. I think that they're using that as their bargaining, their argument chip, you know, to kind of get in the door as to allowing this late-term abortion.
Mary, what do you think that this case, do you think anyone besides us here on Conversations with Consequences is talking about palliative care for babies like this and taking the aggressive attack of abortion out of the equation for these children of God? These are little boys and girls that we should love as much as we love any children who aren't disabled.
Right. Well, I think a couple of points. First of all, I really think that the majority of women who are given a life-limiting diagnosis for their child or an adverse prenatal diagnosis are not told about palliative care the get-go.
I know they're not. I happen to know they're not from the medical perspective.
Yeah. And I was, you know, introduced to it when a friend of mine she was expecting twins, and one of her twins was diagnosed with a rare form of spina bifida. The baby's brain was completely outside the skull. Her twin brother was healthy, and she was really pressured. And she happens to have a master's degree in public health administration. So she went to the medical library by herself and discovered perinatal hospice. Her doctors never mentioned it to her. Mm-hmm. And she was given the additional pressure of being told, if you don't abort this sick twin, your healthy twin may be harmed. And, mm-hmm. you know, which wasn't true at all. You know, the sick baby's
and
illness.
And also in intervening in a twin pregnancy to remove one twin puts the other twin into a great danger.
Right. Exactly. That's what she mm-hmm. discovered. And so she, mm-hmm. they used perinatal hospice. She chose to deliver by C-section to give her little daughter the best chance possible. But when she was delivered, it turns out her condition was even more serious than the doctors had been able to mm-hmm. gauge via ultrasound. But, you know, the beautiful thing of it, so she was baptized right there in the delivery room. She was held by all of her grandparents. You know, her one grandmother is Slovenian and taught her some words in Slovenian so she could say hello to the relatives in heaven when she got there. I mean, it was very, very sweet. And then mm-hmm. you know, she died painlessly in her father's arms. And then, but the beautiful outcome, an additional beautiful outcome, is that her heart valves were used to save two critically ill infants in the Chicago area who would have died without the gifts of those
Mary,
heart valves.
And,
you know, they didn't choose infant organ donation, you know, as a means to an end sort of thing, right? But it was a possibility. And again, she had to go and research it because she thought, you know, she knew of a little boy in her parish, a little infant who died waiting for an organ because so few are available. And so that made her look into it. And then the doctor said, well, you know, because of the baby's condition, extensive organ donation might not be possible, but we might be able to use some. And so they used, I think, her corneas and then her heart valves. But mm-hmm. her heart valves saved two critically ill infant girls who would have died without those gifts. And so, God can always bring good out of these kind of tragic situations. And it wound up being a very healing thing for the family. But so I was aware of it just from my friend's story. And this is going back, 20 years. And then, just as you, the longer you live and your friends get married and, these things happen in families. Mm-hmm. And so I have been doing a lot of research and writing on the particular topic, because over and over again, people sometimes would call me if a family member or friend received a diagnosis of this and ask me what to do. And I would say, ask your doctor about palliative prenatal care or perinatal mm-hmm. care rather. And, again, in almost every case, I can only think of maybe one case where it was mentioned to the family by the doctor first, instead of the family saying, I would rather, not do this. So I had a very medically complex first pregnancy, and termination was the first thing offered to me. And, had I not had kind of my wits about me and, knowing that abortion couldn't be my only option. And I just said, that can't be possible. And then all of a sudden, like Kira points out, then when you tell them you take abortion off the table, all of a sudden there's other options. Go
ahead, Kira. We only have 1 minute left, but please finish up for us and tell us your last thoughts, please.
Research, I think this is a holistic option for humanity, right? Research shows that when patients are given this as an option and presented on the table along with their other options, 80% choose this option. When they're presented, on the right after the diagnosis, 80% of them choose this. It's a holistic option for humanity. I think we have to get it out there and change the protocols and procedures. That's what Rory's Way is trying to do. We're trying to get in front of the doctors, the genetic counselors, and get in front of the medical professionals, as well as offer it for patients and families so people know about it. So it's just a word, it gets spread word of mouth that everyone knows that there's other options. You're not cornered. I think that is the main message here. And you can find beauty and handle it, in a very therapeutic, holistic way. Kira, as another alternative
Kira,
option.
For our listeners who want to know more about Rory's Way, where can they read about that?
Sure. So you can go to rorysway.org, and we have a website up. It has all the additional information, and we can help people get connected with perinatal hospice programs throughout the country.
Thank you so much, Kira.
Thank you for having me.
Your beautiful story and showing us how beauty comes from tragedy and how we can embrace the cross.
And, thanks, Mary.
And do what we're supposed to do with it, right? Which is carry the dignity and courage. Thank you, Mary. Thank you, Kira.
Okay. Thank you. Great to be with you. Thank you for having
us. Bye-bye.
Next, we have Archbishop Cordeleon of San Francisco. He has been on the show before, and he is a wonderful guest, so I'm very much looking forward to that. The Archbishop has been making a point of spending Advent with Mary, and part of that has been the world premiere of two new Advent carols, and these are part of the Benedict XVI Institute for Sacred Music and Divine Worship. The premiere happened on December 10 at the Star of the Sea Church in San Francisco. And Archbishop Cordeleon is going to tell us all about that. Before that, I wanted to share with you the text the lyrics of one of these carols, because one of the carols is a Christmas carol by Chesterton set to music. I want to read that for you because it's so beautiful. It's one of my favorites. The Christ child lay on Mary's lap. His hair was like a light. Oh, weary, weary were the world, but here is all right. The Christ child lay on Mary's breast. His hair was like a star. Oh, stern and cunning are the kings, but here the true hearts are. The Christ child lay on Mary's heart. His hair was like a fire. Oh, weary, weary is the world, but here the world's desire. The Christ child stood at Mary's knee. His hair was like a crown, and all the flowers looked up at him, and all the stars looked down. Welcome to the show, Archbishop Cordeleon.
Thank you.
It's very kind of you to make time for us during a very busy Advent. I know it's been especially busy for you, as I mentioned earlier in the introduction, that you were able to have a beautiful service introducing two new carols to the Christmas Carol canon or Advent Carol canon. of our church. And that's wonderful. We always think of the old classics. Why do you think that these two carols especially were important to add to the canon?
Well, first of all, to show that the canon grows, mm-hmm. right, and develops. It's not stuck in time. What is from the past that endures is of timeless value. So we sing them with great fondness, right? Because they attain the status of classic because they're beautiful and moving in every age and every culture. But we can also continue to add to that canon as past generations have added on to it. And so there really hasn't been that much new added to the canon for the Christmas and Advent cycle. So I thought it would be good to move in that direction. And especially, we have the Chesterton Carol with Mark Nowakowski adapted his composition of that carol to make it adaptable so a good parish choir could sing that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we
premiered
for Very Marian Advent service. So our people can be engaged in singing these new hymns. And then also the poem by Roseanne Sullivan to the O Antiphons, and then the musical composition to that by Mina Parisot. It seems to me there's a growing awareness and appreciation of these O Antiphons. People are beginning to learn about them and how we focus on this last week of Advent in preparing for the birth of Christ through these Christological titles we find in the Old Testament, and how, you know, all the O Antiphons are constructed. More and more people are learning about this pattern of the Sapienza, the Adonai, the Radix Jesse, the Clavis Davi, the Oriens Exalto, Rex Gentium, and the Emmanuel, right? Those are the O Antiphons of wisdom of our God, of the root of Jesse, the key of David, the dawn from on high, the king of the nations, and Emmanuel. These are all Christological titles we find in the Old Testament as we prepare for the birth of Christ. And then how the words in Latin spell backwards. If you go from the last one back to the first, it spells arrow cross, which means I will be there tomorrow.
Oh.
So we sing the antiphons all the way up from December 17th to December 23rd. We end with Emmanuel, I will be there tomorrow. And then Christmas Eve, we celebrate his birth.
So it's a kind of building on the salvation history, on centering ourselves on the long history of salvation, not starting with the miracle in Bethlehem, but yes, many thousands of years before.
Yes, yes. All those many, very many centuries, millennium really, that God was preparing the world for the birth of his son.
Mm-hmm. And you, I'm sure you agree with me that more than any time now, we need to focus in Advent on salvation history, and not on shopping and on our screens and on the elves and the reindeer and the the profusion of ways of distracting ourselves from the actual miracle at hand.
These are all part of life at this time of the year, and I do think they have their place, but they shouldn't consume our attention. Our focus has to be spiritual, and then these other kind of sometimes fun, sometimes aggravating. Not everyone enjoys shopping, you know, but the Christmas decorations and Santas and all that are fun outlets, you know, but they shouldn't be the driving force for us. It should be the spiritual focus during Advent, meditating on these O Antiphons, meditating on these readings from the prophets foretelling the birth of the Messiah, you know, saying the prayers around the Advent wreath, decorating the Christmas tree with the kind of a spiritual awareness of that the Christmas tree represents the tree in the garden from which we lost our friendship with God, and the tree of the cross in the garden by which it was restored by the death of Christ. You know, there's a very profound religious symbolism in the Christmas tree. So all of this coming out of a spiritual focus, we really need in our time to refocus on Jesus Christ. There's so much, so many distractions, as you said, with the materialism, with the social media that can isolate us. It's supposed to connect us, but it's kind of ironic. It ends up isolating us, really. And so many ideologies at war with each other. We can get so caught up in that. We need to refocus on Jesus Christ and being true to him and true to what he teaches.
You wrote very beautifully about focusing on Mary, on making Advent a Marian time. And always, of course, through Mary to Jesus. And that's how I like to think about it, that the best pathway to Jesus is Mary. You wrote in the National Catholic Register in a recent piece about these things that we're talking about. Mothers know full well that the challenges of the last month of pregnancy, the anticipatory joy amid what is often physical suffering or fears of the suffering that childbirth brings. It is the perfect metaphor for what we should be feeling during Advent, the incredible joy of knowing that God humbled himself to become one of us out of his great love for us, a joy, though, mixed with sadness from the realization that it was our own sins that caused this to happen. The cross lies ahead. Why do you focus on the cross during Christmas?
That's why he came into the world, right? That's why God assumed a human body. Mm-hmm. So that in that body, he could offer his life on the cross. So it's our understanding that, speaking about the garden, the tree in the garden, and our first parents, their disobedience, right? They allowed themselves to fall into the trap of the serpent, of the evil one. So we lost our friendship with God. We owe this debt to God because of our transgression against him, against his commandment. We have to repay that debt, but we can't. We don't have our human capacity is limited now, and we cannot repay that on our own. We need someone to repay it for us, but we owe the debt. We have to repay it. Since only God can repay it, but we owe it, God became one of us so that as a man, he could do as God what we can't do as a man, but he can do that as a man. So we focus on the cross because that's why God sent his son to be born of the Virgin Mary. And we see all the elements of the passion there at the birth. You know, the wood of the manger is representing the wood of the cross. The swaddling cloths that he was wrapped in, representing the cloths that wrapped his body and his face after the crucifixion. So he was laid in a manger, right? A manger is a trough. It's a vessel used for feeding animals. So he becomes our food. He continues to make his passion and resurrection present to us in the Holy Eucharist when he becomes our food. So all of the elements are there at the birth of why this baby was born and what his destiny is and our destiny when we live in union with him.
It's a hard thing when you see images of Our Lady holding the baby. You see this often in statues and paintings. She's holding the baby with one arm, and in the other hand, she holds the cross, the torture instrument upon which her baby will grow up to be killed. And his whole life was a mission to the cross. He was a man on a mission from birth. And you say all the elements, how beautifully you say that all the elements were there in that stable or that cave. How can we, in the last few days of Advent that we have left, how can we better enter into the full significance of Christ coming among us?
Well, of course, we can't focus on Mary without focusing on Christ. As you said, it's to Mary, to Jesus through Mary, because she was the instrument by which God came into the world, and her whole life is oriented toward her son, presenting her son to the world, the Theotokos, right? They say in the Christianese, the God-bearer. She continues to be the God-bearer for us from heaven, presenting her son to the world. So through her, we reach Jesus. She's the chosen vessel. So to enter into that Marian spirituality by especially praying the rosary, meditating on the gospel passages for this last week of Advent, they're very profound and ingenious the way the church has set this up, where every day in this last week is the parallel narratives of the Annunciation and birth of John the Baptist, and then the Annunciation of the birth of Jesus leading up to the narrative of his birth on Christmas Eve. They're brought together, the parallel narratives are brought together at the Visitation. So to meditate on those. And Also to enter into a kind of a penitential spirit. Advent is also a penitential time, not as drastically so as Lent, but still it's a time of preparation. The church always understands when we're preparing for a great feast, we do so by acts of penitence and especially fasting. So try to observe some kind of fasting during this last week of Advent as we prepare ourselves to welcome Christ when he comes, creating that space for God to act in our life.
Archbishop, I wonder if you could give us maybe also some words of comfort, maybe focused on the nativity of our Lord and these things that we have spoken about. In times when the church confusing things are coming to us from the church itself, and I don't think we need to spell it out, but it's a time of confusion for many of us and maybe feeling that we can't always rely on things that we felt we could rely on. How does the nativity of our Lord comfort us at these times of insecurity?
Yes, I understand what you mean. This year marks 800 years that St. Francis set up that first manger scene, the nativity scene. You know, it was his vision. He wanted to really to enter into that mystery and be present to it. So think realistically what that was like. We kind of romanticize it, which I suppose is fine in a way, but I mean, they were basically in a cave where animals were kept. And it was in wintertime. Jesus was born at this time, in during the night. So it was cold, they're in a cave, there's straw there, there are animals. We know what animals smell like.
Yeah.
And what they leave on the ground and what that smells like, because so you can imagine the conditions
for a mother giving birth.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah, no one would take them in. Mm-hmm. They had no lodging and those dire conditions. And this is where God chose to enter the world. But there's such love there, and that's the thing that makes the difference in the midst of suffering. In the midst of deprivation, and in our times, we can say in the midst of confusion, there's no confusion when love is present. We know when love is present. Love is when we're willing to make sacrifices to make the other happy. So I'd say try to enter into that true spirit of love, especially as families, to try to seek family unity, to go out of your way to show kindness to family members. You know, don't always insist on getting your own way. Do chores, do others' chores for them without being asked. This helps to build up so much love and unity and then eventually joy in family life and prepares us for the life of heaven because God created us for communion, right? And love is what makes us capable of that communion. So the more we live the call of love in our families, especially, the more we create that capacity for communion and capacity for the life of heaven.
Well, those are perfect words to end on, Archbishop. Thank you so much for joining us. Please hold all of our listeners in your prayers this Christmas that we may rest in that beautiful cave or stable with Our Lady and Saint Joseph and the baby and learn to love like they loved.
Amen. Okay, will do.
I share this Advent reflection for you, even though we are now in the last couple of days of Advent. These days, the frenzied commercialism of Christmas starts even before Thanksgiving, as though to maximize the stress and headache that have come to characterize the season. The Church proposes something very different for Advent, the liturgical period that leads up to that tender moment when the Virgin Mary lifts her little newborn and shows him to the world. We are reminded in no uncertain terms that our attitude should be one of keen attentiveness, of being on guard. In Jesus' own words, "What I say to you, I say to everyone. Watch." It's exactly the opposite of our secular culture's call to distraction and inattention. There are greater things afoot during Advent than shopping and decorating, deep things of giant import and eternal consequences. A battle rages around us, and woe to those who bury themselves in the Cyber Monday sales and neglect to look up. Will they miss their moment? Will they miss their chance to align themselves with the finest impulses and noblest intuitions of their hearts? The first coming of Jesus to a dusty stable in a little village of a minor Roman colony was missed by almost everyone. Humble shepherds sunk in the perfect silence of a winter meadow heard the first Noel And wise men from afar, who scanned the stars for heavenly news, discovered the herald comet. No one will miss the second coming. As we learn from Christ himself, it will be prefigured by days of distress unequaled from the beginning, when God created the world until now, and never to be equaled again. It is during those dark days that the Son of Man will return, not as before, as a defenseless babe worn by the breath of oxen, but coming in clouds with great power and glory. It will be too late then for those who are scattered and inattentive, for his angels are coming with him to gather the elect. But today it is not too late. Be on guard, be alert, look up from the screen and look around you. Look higher, pay attention so that you may hear the good news of his coming, so that you can ready your heart to receive him. Do not, for any reason, miss your chance to welcome him. And now Father Roger Landry offers us, as is customary, a short and inspiring homily to prepare us for this Sunday's Gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry, and it's a joy to have a chance to ponder with you the consequential conversation God wants to have with us on the fourth Sunday of Advent and on Christmas. Because the fourth Sunday and Christmas take place this year on back-to-back days, I'd like to try to mention both in our conversation. On Sunday this year, the Church has us ponder Mary and the mystery of the Annunciation, what preceded the birth of Christ in Bethlehem. Church invites us, so to speak, to climb within Mary's womb so that we might draw close to that womb's blessed fruit as he is silently growing and try to calibrate our prayer to Mary's contemplative heartbeat. Mary is, in a sense, Advent personified. She's the one whom God himself prepared through her Immaculate Conception for the incarnation and birth of his Son, the Word of God. What lessons do we learn from Mary as we ponder the scene of the Archangel Gabriel's visit to her, asking if she would become the mother of the Son of God? The first thing is that we need to allow God to clean our interior abode, as God did with Mary through her Immaculate Conception. God gives us that grace through baptism and confession. In this way, Mary, each Advent, continues the work of St. John the Baptist, gently, maternally, calling us to be free from sin so that, like her, we may welcome God within. Have you made a good confession yet this Advent? The second thing Mary helps us to do is to pray. She's a model of prayer. Her expectant prayer was the culmination of centuries of supplications of the Jewish people awaiting the Messiah. She treasured everything in her heart. She longed for God. The Archangel Gabriel said to her, "The Lord is with you." She always sought to be with the Lord. Mary wants to help us during these days to enter her contemplative academy. May we be good students. The third thing Mary wants to help us learn is amazement at the mysteries we're celebrating. As pure as she was, as much as she prayed, little could she have ever imagined that the long-awaited Messiah would be God the Son, and that God the Son would be her Son, according to the flesh. She became for 9 months the living temple of God. Sometimes when the practice of the faith becomes routine, we can lose our sense of wonder. The Church has us ponder Mary to help us rekindle the wonder of our minds and hearts at the mystery of the Incarnation, not merely 2,000 years ago, but now, in the ongoing incarnation of the Holy Eucharist. Without that wonder, we can't appreciate Bethlehem. Fourth, Mary teaches us about how God's life is meant to grow within us and change our life. Like the baby Jesus did in Mary, Jesus wants to take on our flesh, to change the way we eat, sleep, walk, and live, and eventually to become so big that we can no longer contain him within. What took place for Mary, Pope Benedict once said, can daily take place in each of us, in the hearing of the word and in the celebration of the sacraments. It not only can take place, but is supposed to, if only we learn from Mary how to cooperate. So the way we need to prepare for Christmas is to relive Mary's mystery in Christ, to live by faith like her, to abandon ourselves to God's love, to entrust ourselves to his plan. That's what the Church underlines this year on the fourth Sunday of Advent. That brings us to Christmas. There are four different Gospels to ponder. At the Vigil Mass, we hear St. Matthew's version of the appearance of the angel to St. Joseph, affirming that Jesus was conceived by the Holy Spirit and helping us to relate to Jesus by the names Emmanuel, or God with us, and Jesus, or God saves. At Midnight Mass, we focus on what the angel said and sang to the vigilant shepherds about Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. At Mass at dawn, we ponder how the shepherds hastily ran to Bethlehem to pay homage to Jesus and to relate to Mary and Joseph what the angels had said to them. And Mass during the day, we focus on St. John's profound words about how in the baby Jesus, the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, and we have seen his glory. Each of these readings are worthy of dedicating an entire retreat, not to mention a homily. But what I'd like to focus on is another type of consequential conversation we're called to have this Christmas. The dialogue that's supposed to occur for us before the creche. We live at a time in which Christmas manger scenes are so much a part of Catholic piety that many believe that they must have existed from the first centuries of Christianity, but they're actually an invention of St. Francis of Assisi 800 years ago this year, when he created the first living nativity in the mountainous Italian village of Greccio, located about halfway between Rome and Assisi. The topography and architecture of Greccio, where Francis would frequently stay to preach and to pray, reminded him of Bethlehem, which he had visited 4 years before. So with the permission of Pope Honorius III, with the help of Greccio's chief nobleman, Giovanni Valetti, Francis decided to try to bring the mystery of Bethlehem alive. His first biographer, Thomas of Celano, said that of Greccio there was made, as it were, a new Bethlehem. Per Francis's instructions, Valetti arranged in a cave an ox, an ass, and a manger full of straw. The townspeople came in huge numbers with tapers and torches that combined to illumine the night like the ancient Star of Bethlehem. Directly over the manger, a makeshift altar was erected to celebrate Mass. It's the only recorded time that St. Francis served as a deacon. He chanted the gospel, Celano tells us, with an earnest, sweet, clear, and sound voice, preached mellifluous words concerning the birth of the poor king in the little town of Bethlehem, and with exceeding love called people to adore the Bambino. Celano notes the impact the living nativity in the Mass had on the townspeople. He writes, "The child Jesus had been forgotten in the hearts of many, but by the working of divine grace he was brought to life again through his servant Francis and stamped upon their fervent memory." Note that the details of the birth of Christ hadn't been forgotten in people's heads. They had, however, failed to penetrate their hearts and lives. While they still knew the facts, devotion had grown cold. The nativity scene in the Mass, the Gospel, the homily, and the living presence of Christ in the Eucharist combined to revivify it. This Christmas, as we look with gratitude to the living nativity of 1223, it's important to remember the lessons of Greccio. For the last several years, Pope Francis has been trying to lead the whole Church to Greccio, and through Greccio to Bethlehem, and through Bethlehem to the baby Jesus, and from the baby Jesus to Christ today. This past Wednesday, the Holy Father dedicated his general audience to the octocentenary. Last month, the Vatican published a book entitled Christmas at the Nativity, compiling Pope Francis' words over the last decade about nativity scenes. In it, the Holy Father emphasized that the creche is a living gospel overflowing from the pages of Holy Scripture. It's a conversation that brings us into dialogue. Pope Francis himself has visited Greccio twice, in 2016 and 2019, and on that second occasion he signed a beautiful apostolic letter on the meaning and importance of nativity scenes, encouraging the faithful to set them up not only in their homes but in workplaces, schools, hospitals, prisons, and town squares. He urged us to use the creche both to pray and evangelize, emphasizing the Christmas creche is part of the precious yet demanding process of passing on the faith. Beginning in childhood and at every stage of our life, it teaches us to contemplate Jesus, to experience God's love for us, and to believe that God is with us and that we are with him, his brothers, sisters, and all, thanks to that child who is the Son of God and the Son of the Virgin Mary. But I'd like to underline one more connection that both St. Francis and Pope Francis make, because it's essential to the Eucharistic revival taking place in the Church in the United States. There in the cave of Greccio, Francis built an altar over the manger, to show the connection between the child Jesus, whom Mary, Joseph, the angels, the shepherds, the magi, and animals adored in Bethlehem, and the Eucharistic Jesus that the Church in heaven and on earth continues to worship on the altar. Pope Francis said that when the priest in Greccio solemnly celebrated the Eucharist over the manger, the bond between the incarnation of the Son of God and the Eucharist was highlighted. There is this tight bond between the two that we should never miss or take for granted. We can say with the wonder of the shepherds and wise men that the one who would be called Emmanuel, or God with us, by his own supremely loving decision has chosen to remain with us until the end of time in the Holy Eucharist. The one born in Bethlehem, literally house of bread in Hebrew, has come as the living bread come down from heaven so that we might eat of him and experience salvation from death. The Mass is the means Christ himself implemented, we can say, to perpetuate, revivify, and advance the mystery of Bethlehem. As we prepare to go to Bethlehem spiritually with the help of our manger scenes, we do so conscious that we have the privilege to do something that the shepherds, magi, and even Joseph and Mary didn't have the chance to do in Bethlehem, to receive within us and adore on the inside the one whom they only adored outside in swaddling clothes. That's where our consequential conversation is meant to lead us. What an incredible gift we have. Oh, come, let us adore him on this fourth Sunday of Advent, on Christmas, and beyond. Merry Christmas. God bless you.
Thank you, Father Landry. To hear more from Father Landry, check out his website at catholicpreaching.com, and you can also catch his writings at EWTN's own National Catholic Register. A big thank you to all our listeners for joining us. I hope that this show was helpful. I hope that it gave you more peace and more hope and more joy, and you go with our prayers.